Guess what? We are back for another episode of the Esports Central podcast. This time, it's number 84, and I'm Carmel, joined by Mr. Prophecy. How are you doing today, my good man?
I'm doing pretty damn well. We're about to end the actual hard lockdown. Now we're just going into stage four, which is lockdown with a twist.
So we are recording on the 30th of April. This is the day of recording. It'll come out a few days later, of course, for you listeners to hear. But it is the end of hard lockdown, and we see a sort of Uno reverse going on. The smokers are in shambles because they did a hint that they were going to unban cigarettes, and now it's like about that, and people have lost their shit. It's hilarious to see.
I mean, smokers just they need their fix. I mean, I can understand that, you know, it is something of an addiction, so it's not that they can do anything about it. But you'd think that, you know, the number of smokers going around would have decreased sharply during this period if they were forced to, and some people maybe even took the challenge. But yeah, you can understand that it just started. You know, it's like it was supposed to only be 3 weeks, and they all stocked up, and now it's been 5 weeks, and there's not much more that they can do.
Yeah, I did use the word hilarious, but there actually needs to be some sympathy out there. People are addicted. The word addicted is not a thing we just throw out like the WHO and say gaming is addiction and stuff. It's a real thing, and we shouldn't laugh about it. But the tweets going out are a little funny. You gotta take some time to appreciate humor.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you can't have humor in this period, then it's gonna be a very, very long, a very, very long time in your life.
Yeah, the memes is about the only thing we got right now. But what else we got is actually one of my favorite topics on this podcast. It's not actually Dota 2. It's not making fun of Sargon. Okay, that actually is my favorite by far. But my second favorite thing, actually, we get to flame Overwatch League Prophecy. And this is something that's coming up shortly. But before we get to that, we have another thing of our other favorite publisher, of course. You know, Riot Games and their ever so great rulings on near everything. What is the most recent situation that happened with Doublelift and Team Liquid?
All right, so I mean, basically, there's been a whole stink, primarily led by Thorin and Monty.
As always,
you know, like, well, yeah, I guess you could say that as always. I mean, like, there is a lot of dodgy things going on, but essentially, what's happened is that Doublelift, the star carry, one of the best players in North America, has moved from or back. He's moved back from Team Liquid to Team Solo Mid, TSM, and all seemed kind of hunky-dory. I mean, not many people could understand why you'd trade probably one of the best players in the entire league to one of your arch rivals, which is a bit odd. It must be said that Team Liquid didn't have the best of splits in spring. I think they came sixth or something. I forget exactly, but they missed playoffs. They really weren't in a great state, and Doublelift himself just seemed massively off the pace. The whole team looked pretty janky. TSM a little bit better, and they didn't quite make the final, but still looked a lot better than Team Liquid had. And especially with Team Liquid being the four-time back-to-back champions, you'd expect a little bit more out of them anyway. But regardless, I mean, trading a superstar player is not unheard of. Does raise a couple of questions as to the ambition of your team if you're trading a player like that, but he seemed to want to go, so he left. And then the news came out that he'd been dating the president of TSM, a lady by the name of Lena, which raised a lot of questions. Because why in the hell is a player allowed to date any member of staff from another team? And it raised a lot of conflict of interest questions. Again, Monty and Thorin were the ones primarily driving this. The fans don't seem to mind too much, but it does still, like, especially when looking at competitive integrity and certain conflict of interest, there's like a lot of questions. Because if we bring it back to, you know, like a sports example, like we always like to use, imagine you traded LeBron from the Cleveland Cavaliers to the Golden State Warriors. And then 2 months after that, you find out that before they even shifted that player, he was dating one of the senior management of Golden State Warriors, and he'd been absolutely terrible before the trade.
So from an outside perspective for me, because I haven't followed the situation too intensely, I do see why it looks bad, but is there a way Like, I mean, there's certain examples where you can see the conflict of interest directly from a financial point of view, from a business point of view. This, it's more of a roundabout way from a personal side that's affecting business, right? So do you think Riot has anything in place to counteract this? Or is it a case of, like, I don't know, NBA is a good example when everybody was doing rumors about Kawhi Leonard and his uncle Dennis negotiating and talking behind the backs and all that kind of stuff. I don't know, is it similar to that, or is it a case of Riot actually have rules in place to counteract this sort of personal slash business relation?
Well, I mean, the thing is, Riot signed off on this, but in the past, Riot has come down extraordinarily heavily on a lot of the smaller teams, it must be said. For example, the old Renegades lineup, there was some shady shit going on with their ownership at the time. Monty was involved, but Monty, is, from what I understand, Monty was cleared of actually being the one responsible for any of the shady shit. He was just like friends with the guy who did this. But as a result, because
and the guy he was friends with, did it have anything to do with his team in that situation? Sorry.
The team Monty owned at the time was called Renegades, and the owner of the team, either owner of the team or the manager of the team, I forget exactly what position he held. It was significant. Let's put it that way.
Okay,
he was,
you know,
like second in charge, basically, to Monty, who was mostly the figurehead because he was sitting in Korea. So this guy was running the team for the most part, even though he wasn't officially an owner. Chris Badawi is his name. Now, Chris Badawi was accused of player tampering and what's the other thing? But basically, he was accused of speaking to players before the... he was accused of speaking to players without informing the teams of doing so, which in American sports is a big no-no. You're not allowed talking to a player before his contract reaches a certain point. And you have to speak to his team if you want to do so. If they say, yes, it's fine, we're willing to sell him, but you need to, you know, get him to agree, that's a different story. Now, Chris Badawi was accused of not doing that through the proper channels and in the proper order. And as a result, he was kicked out of League of Legends. He was removed from ever being able to own any portion of a team. He was basically prevented from ever getting involved in League of Legends again. And Monty was forced to sell his team by Riot in an extraordinarily amount, a short amount of days. Like, we're talking something along the lines of, I think he had 2 months or something to sell his team, which is like, I mean, think about that. As soon as everybody knows, okay, this guy's got 2 months, they can immediately just screw you on any sort of deal when buying it out, because they know you have to, you know, by Riot's law, sell the team.
Yeah, all your leverage is gone in negotiations.
Then there was another instance of, so you can see they came down pretty heavily on that. People are like, okay, it's fine. You know, things went down. Those are your findings. We're not going to dispute those, but perhaps a little bit harsh nailing Monty when he had almost nothing to do with it, but it's fine. If that's precedent you've set, you know, we can all live with that. But then you also have another situation where in Europe, the I think he was the owner of G2 at a stage, loaned money to Fnatic. Now, you can already see Fnatic and G2 are the two biggest teams in Europe. And as soon as one guy can have anything to do with both teams, it starts asking questions. Then it came out that if Fnatic had been unable to pay back his loan at any point, so for example, let's say you default on 1 month, the entirety of Fnatic would be owned by this guy. He's also a part owner of G2.
Wow, that is wild.
So you can, like, this is now a major conflict of interest, because owning two teams, and especially the top two teams in the league, that would, like, immediately set every alarm bell from here to Timbuktu ringing as, you know, like, massive problems coming through. Regardless, Riot's ruling, Fnatic had to reverse the loan, those exact words, reverse the loan, and the deal wasn't allowed to happen. That's it. Nothing further.
So we are seeing a very clear pattern of, what is the word? Inconsistent behavior.
Yes.
From Riot Games.
Depending on the size of your team and how much you've caused problems for them, basically, yes.
So it's quite funny, because if you look at the situation, right, it's clear to see that it is a personal thing to Monty that this double lift thing is such a clear sort of contradiction from Riot's right side. So there's a personal aspect there. It's also a case of, now we're double lift dating a team owner. Now, you can't exactly tell people who they can and can't date, although it is in some contracts. It is a case of how do you now prevent talks happening outside of that transfer season? Because even Chelsea, they got a transfer ban because apparently they were in talks with players outside of the transfer season. And trying to create relationships and maybe potential transfers for the transfer season before the date they're allowed to do that. So they got a transfer ban in the Premier League. So it is a very fishy situation. That is for sure. And it doesn't look like Riot have anything in place to deal with this. It's just a case of, okay, we Riot Games and we're going to do whatever the hell we want, which is an issue, Prof.
I mean, it is a major issue. It's going to bring up a point that we're going to talk about later, but that is exactly the problem, is that there's no consistency between decisions. You know, if it's no tampering, no talking to players before certain, you know, like if, like, I think it's in, is it in soccer? I'm not exactly certain. I think it's in soccer. You can start talking to the player 6 months before their contract ends, is what you're officially, that's when a club is officially allowed to start talking to a player. Before then, so basically what that means is that if I'm in the last 6 months of my contract and Camille is the owner of Arsenal, Camille can come to me and say, when your contract ends, I want you to join my team and here's the contract I can give you, right? So at that point, I run out the rest of my contract, no changes to anything. I still play for the team that I'm playing with, and then I join Arsenal when that 6 months ends. If it's more than 6 months before that, say, for example, a year, Camille has to go to my team and offer my team to buy out my contract, or at least speak to my team and ask them if they're going to, you know, if they will offer me a new contract. So if they say no, but you can buy him out, Camille has to then pay a transfer fee for me, offer that to my team. If my team accepts, he can then enter into discussions with me. If I say no, no deal. If I say yes, we can we sign a deal and then I'll join him either immediately or at a later point in time. So you want consistency in these decisions. The fact that we've got like there's like all this talk of a player just joining, or you know, a player dating. So like if I was dating somebody in the Arsenal organization and came out that I was joining this team, it's like immediately asks questions, because is my motivation to play for my team there? Is like, am I going to potentially tank a game that could help Arsenal out? You know, if I'm in the final game of the season and I can beat my opponents by scoring a penalty, for example, and if I beat this opponent, Arsenal wins the league, it's immediately a lot of, you know, questions being asked, because if I miss that penalty and it helps Arsenal win the league, and then it comes out that I'm dating somebody from Arsenal, or, you know, let's say I'm dating the manager's daughter from Arsenal, there's a lot of problems when that comes through, because you can't have that between teams. And that's why conflicts of interest are especially banned in professional leagues. Now, the fact that we have devs that can basically just decide on a whim whether they like you or not, or how important you are to the league, is a very, very dangerous and very slippery slope, because you don't want Man United to get preferential treatment because they make more money than a Burnley, or the let's say, like, you don't want the Dallas Cowboys in the NFL to get better treatment than the Bengals just because they make more money. It, you know, that immediately puts you in a situation where it's a lot of dangerous precedents being set, because if that happens, then any big team will start doing that. And you start creating a situation where everything becomes very, very favorable to the big teams and unfavorable to the little ones.
I mean, realistically speaking, it does happen in almost every industry, right? I mean, the Real Madrid and the Barcelonas, they probably do get preference from FIFA when they do a lot of shady things. But the fact of the matter is, you can't, that those things cannot be seen by the public. It can't be blatant, right? So I'm not going to be like some super utopian and pretend that that shit doesn't happen in sports. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, it's so clear here in Riot's case. And it's not just Riot who are giving preferential treatment and stuff, which we'll get to a bit later. But it doesn't look good. I mean, if you have Messi's aunt dating the president of Real Madrid, and then the next transfer window, he transfers from Barcelona to Real Madrid, it looks shady as hell. There's going to be a lot of questions asked, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you'd want. You want there to be a fair and open playing field. You know, it's like, sure, Real Madrid makes more money, so they can afford to pay a bigger transfer fee if that happens. Perfectly fine. So long as it's all above board, nobody cares. But when it's like, when it starts becoming like, this guy is incentivized to play worse for another team, it's, you know, that's exactly when you have to start asking questions, because that should never, ever occur.
Yeah, and I think the bigger question here is not even just about the tampering between Liquid and TSM, between Doublelift and TSM's owner or manager. The question is about inconsistency from developers in esports, yeah. Right? Because Riot's behavior here, from the G2 situation with Fnatic to Monte Cristo's situation with Renegades to now Doublelift situation with the owner of TSM, or sorry, the manager of TSM, it is not consistent at all. And it's not just Riot Games. Because if you look at Valve, they came down very hard on conflict of interest. There was that huge blog post with CSGO about conflict of interest in Dota 2. They said no teams are allowed to have... LGD can't have LGD main team, LGD junior. Yep. So there was that big ruling. And now recently, Prof, what was the situation at MIBR?
Okay, so in CSGO, we got a number of teams. It's not only MIBR. It was just this is the situation that came up. But we have had it in the past where one player from a very wealthy org, for example, in Na'Vi, we had Zeus. He had ownership in a small Russian team called Pro 100. Now, they never played each other because Na'Vi was almost never in the same levels of tournaments as Pro 100. But still, on the off chance that they ever did meet, there were certainly questions to be asked. Now, again, the player owns the org, or he's giving money to the org, so he's helping out the little guy. It makes sort of a feel-good story, but you just never want them to ever play each other in a tournament for obvious reasons. It can, again, affect competitive integrity. Now, what happened with the MIBR situation is almost the exact same, except instead of one player owning a part of the team, the entirety of MIBR, well, maybe not the entirety, let's say majority of the players and the manager from MIBR owned a portion of this YEAH team, YEAH. Yeah. Also, all Brazilian teams. So, sort of sponsoring the little guys, helping them out. And then in the qualification for the major, these two teams ended up playing against one another. Now, obviously, the incentive is you can go as the owner of the org to these young kids and say, look, guys, we need you to lose so that we can make it to the major, so that we can keep paying your bills.
And just a correction, we're not saying that's happening, but from a business point of view, you have to take that into account. Yes, exactly.
And that is at the core issue. Now, as Camille mentioned, a year or two ago, Valve came down pretty hard on this. Absolutely none of this is allowed. You have to divest your teams, or you have to divest your interest in any team, because this was originally what happened with the Astralis players, is that when Astralis was originally created, players got a portion or they owned a tiny piece of Astralis, say, for example, 1% of Astralis. And when they left Astralis, they kept that percentage. So now when you're playing against Astralis, your incentive is, if I lose this, Astralis loses money. If I win this, Astralis loses money. So if I lose it, Astralis makes more money. Therefore, I can make more money than I'm making here. Kind of problem. Valve came down pretty heavily on it. Sorry, that's not allowed, et cetera, et cetera. It now transpired a couple of weeks ago as well that I think, if I remember correctly, it is the current IGL for Mouse Sports, Carrigan. He still owns a portion of Astralis. Now, again, it's a tiny portion. He has no voting rights. He has absolutely no control over anything to do with Astralis other than the fact that he owns a tiny portion of the company. But again, he can be monetarily incentivized to play worse when playing against Astralis so that they can make more money, so that he can potentially get a bigger payout if the team is ever sold, if the team makes a profit. For any reason, possibly, he can make money out of that. Out of a direct rival. And that is, again, a worrying stance, because Valve is seemingly okay with this when 2 years ago they were trigger happy and said, no, this none of this is allowed, which is, it's fine. But again, please make up your decision and stick to that decision, because if you made that decision 2 years ago and everybody, for example, let's use it again. I own part of Arsenal. I can't do anything with that money other than when Arsenal makes money, I maybe get a tiny portion of it. Right? Valve comes in, makes this decision. Sorry, you have to get rid of that portion of money. I get rid of it, Camille doesn't. 2 years later, down the line, Valve is seemingly okay with Camille still owning his portion, and I'm the one who now got forced to sell my money, to sell my portion of Arsenal.
And so, Prof, this isn't hypotheticals you're speaking. I mean, this inconsistency from Valve fucked over so many people, to be completely honest. I mean, if we look on the Dota side, right? LGD used to field two teams at TI7. They fielded the main LGD team, they fielded the LGD Forever Young team, they used to field the CDEC development team that made it to the TI5 finals. Yep. So in the Chinese Dota scene, this junior level teams that were owned by the same org were a massive part of player development. We should see so many young players come through the orgs like yep. that, right? And now they all had to divest all this shit. Not that LGD did
officially,
right?
Because let's be fair, like the Chinese orgs are famous for that in League of Legends and in Dota 2. They're famous for that. Like officially, they don't own any portion of the teams. Unofficially, people know that certain people own like parts of three teams in the league. So
100%. So the thinking from Valve to stop conflict of interest, there's nothing wrong with that. We are not criticizing that at all. In fact, we probably fucking agree with that. Yeah. But the implementation, when it's like, okay, today our developer, the guy whose job it is to write blog posts, feels like conflict of interest, an issue, he's going to write it. But then tomorrow, when we're selling Half-Life Alex and you know what, we're making big VR money and we got this new development going on, we don't really give a fuck. That is affecting a lot of people, yeah.
Yeah. It's affecting a huge amount of people because, like we said, some people are forced to sell, other people are not. But there's no rhyme or reason for it. It's just who feels right on the day. And like that is unacceptable in a competitive environment where people expect things to be above board, to be played fairly, and there to be no match fixing or any of that shit. Because match fixing happens to this day. You don't want to give people any more incentive to start match fixing, because as soon as that happens, we've seen how Valve reacted the last time. Now you're going to have a situation where it could potentially be, oh, but Valve, you know, allowed us to own a portion of the team. That is going to look absolutely terrible if that ever gets out into a situation like that.
So that segues us now to the main topic of tonight. And what inspired this topic is an article that came out by Matthew Ball. It was titled "Esports and the Dangers of Serving at the Pleasure of a King." What this article was about, in my understanding at the very least, was the relationship between publisher and third party. And by third party, I mean teams, TOs like ESL and such. And by publishers, I mean obviously the publishers, the Riots, the Valves, the Epics, and how these things function in coexistence. I don't know if coexistence is the right word, because it's the complete opposite of coexistence I'm going to talk about.
How the relationship works.
Yes, how the relationship works. And it was quite a stark article to read, because I read this whole thing and then I thought about a certain man named Prophecy, and I was like, holy shit, this guy's been telling me this this whole time. And one of the quotes from Matthew Ball to start things off is, he thinks it's really hard to overemphasize how different — this is a quote from him directly — How everything about esports leagues and traditional sports leagues differ, right? He's how different these two things are. And he says, in fact, he thinks many of the problems could have been avoided if we use the term like professional video games instead. Now, let's start off with his first example here, where he thinks that the differences of esports and traditional sports, right? So we have the NBA, we have UEFA, we have FIFA. These guys are the governing bodies of the basketball in America is governed by the NBA. FIFA is a global body of football. But the case of sports is that they're bodies governing leagues, governing players signed contracts with things, but they don't really own the game, so to speak, right? Prophecy. Yeah,
they don't own the intellectual property.
Right. A football is not FIFA's thing, right? I can have a football. Your neighbor can have a football. We can play soccer, and we don't need permission from FIFA to do that.
Yep. Don't need permission from FIFA to run our own events type thing. So FIFA controls certain events that agree to join FIFA, but if they break out of FIFA, it's not like they're illegal. They can just run their own event, and they're just not allowed attending FIFA's events.
Well, in esports, that's a stark difference, because, I mean, the example he gives in his article about Riot Games and ESL's relationship, or IEM Katowice's, the initial world championship was the IEM, correct, Prof?
It was one of the world championships. It's just kind of a name, but IEM was considered one of the biggest events of the year in League of Legends.
Right. So how that relationship panned out at that time was that IEM ended up hosting one of the world championships for Riot for League of Legends. It was a massive event, one of the monumental feats and most important events in esports history as a whole, right? And then the next year, this Riot decides that they don't want to do this anymore. They don't want third-party organizers doing this. And this third-party organizer wasn't a small thing. This is what turned out to be ESL, arguably the biggest third-party organizer in the world. But this third-party organizer who built their entire business premise on doing events like Riot's League of Legends is now a case of, okay, the biggest event we've ever hosted is now something we can never do again. Because Riot say, we're going to host this league and we are the sole body. And this is where the big distinction comes from between sports and esports. They decide they are the sole body and they have full right to do that because they own the soccer ball. They can legitimately tell, if I'm Carmel and I'm Riot Games, I can say, Prophecy, the soccer ball is mine. You cannot go outside and play with your friends with it. You cannot go and put it on TV. You cannot go and do anything with it because it's actually mine. So this is the first big distinction between sports and esports, right? I think one of the soccer, right, Prophecy?
Yeah, and the thing is, I can't, it's not like it's not like a soccer ball where I can go, I can just go buy my own soccer ball. No, no, no. Camille owns every soccer ball ever made. So if he says you're not allowed playing with one, you're not allowed playing with one. You can't make one that's a copy. You can't buy one from somebody else. He says he's the only one allowed playing with it. He's the only one allowed playing with it, pure and simple.
And if you're listening at home and you're like, okay, you guys are technically correct in what you're saying, and yeah, ESL got screwed there, but I mean, is it really that bad? Because we look at other games, we see Dota 2, we see CSGO, where tournament organizers are relatively free. But is it complete freedom? Because like we just saw in the topic earlier, when it suits Valve or Riot, they can say, this is not how it's done. We don't agree with it. And they have no accountability and no consistency there.
They can say, you can't take them to court and argue them. We'll argue with them. They own the IP, which means that they own everything and are the only ones that can make that decision.
100%. So today, ESL and Flashpoint, for example, are very happy hosting their premier CSGO esports leagues. But the fact of the matter is, tomorrow, Valve can just say, you are not allowed to use our IP. Just full stop. That's all they need to do in a blog post, and it's dead. 100% dead. All the planning, all the, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is the vision for the future. This is how it's going to pan out. And it's all gone. Now, realistically, that probably won't happen, as Matthew Ball points out in his article, because the thinking is that what is esports at the end of the day? It is marketing, right? It's marketing for the game. So it works both ways. Every time the game gets bigger, let's say Dota 2, the TOs are happier because there are going to be more people coming on the Twitch stream to watch the ESL 1 Hamburgs, to watch the DreamHack Masters, etc. So if you think about it, it should be a symbiotic relationship because it's a win-win for both publisher and for esports tournament organizers.
Yep.
But in reality, things can be a little different because in the NBA, the example that Matthew Ball gives, the bosses, the boss of the NBA is actually the team owners, right?
Yeah. They own the NBA. So the NBA is basically just every owner in the league has a spot, and then there's one guy, I think it's one Adam Silver, if I remember correctly.
He's the commissioner.
He's the man given the responsibility to make decisions for the league as a whole. But the league is the teams in the league. They each own a portion, and they decide how the league is run. Nobody else decides how the NBA is run, only the people that are owning part of it.
Right. But in esports, it's completely different because you have, and I'm going to stick on the tournament organizers part of this discussion for now, and then we'll go to teams later. Yep. Because in esports, you have the publishers, the Riots and the Valves, and then you have third-party organizers. So these guys are just coming out from not nowhere, but they basically, like I said, the third party is the correct term, from their own perspective, and they're like, okay, let's do this thing, right? So they put down prize money, they get sponsorships, it's all good. But it's not complete freedom. It's a half freedom because like Valve decides tomorrow, no betting sponsors are allowed. It impacts the Dota scene massively because betting sponsors were a huge part of how people funded esports events. Maybe there's a whole moral argument about betting and such for minors, but that's a whole different story. The fact of the matter is that's where the money came from. Now the situation
The point is Valve has the ability to just say you're not allowed using that. And if you don't use that, I'll take away your license. Simple as that.
Yeah. So we've spoken about a lot of the issues from hosting events as a third-party organizer versus the publisher, because I use the word versus because it can be like that sometimes, and publishers are at the end-all and be-all, and they can just change things like the betting sponsors we mentioned earlier, like for IEM, that they cannot host League of Legends anymore. But what's the other relationship that we mentioned with teams and these publishers, right? And to do that, let's use Overwatch League, for example. So Overwatch League started off as this massive, the new NBA, where Blizzard are the guys who invented the soccer ball, and they're going to run the competitive league, and nobody else was allowed to do it. Yes, there was exceptions for small leagues and such, but for the most part, the only major tournament for Overwatch would be the Overwatch League. So they started off, and they used the good old American sports model, where there's a league, and there's a buy-in to get a slot in that league. They were talking about broadcast rights, all very, very similar things to sport. But the implementation of it, Prophecy, was very different. So teams are putting up a large amount of money to get into this league. Correct.
Yeah, every single huge amounts of money. We're talking, I mean, minimum buy-ins that we were hearing was $5
million. $5 million. And this is for something that has just come out, has never existed before. It's not like soccer, who was played 100 years before the English Premier League was like, okay, let's try monetize this, let's try send things. But it worked out for Blizzard side, right? They got a huge amount of buy-ins. There were so many teams in the Overwatch League. They started off by advertising. They have a $75 million with Twitch. They got these huge sponsorships like Toyota and stuff. But in practice, it was a case of, okay, this is great for Blizzard side, but how was it for the team side? Because the prize money for the first league of Overwatch was, well, let's just say it didn't even cover one team's buy-in. And that's just part of it. Because all the sponsors and stuff now locked all those teams who bought into Overwatch League to a
I was just going to say that, like, you weren't allowed your own sponsors, so Blizzard had to prior approve any sponsor.
So Blizzard had to approve your sponsors because Overwatch League had the sponsors of their own. So now teams were locked into sponsors. They couldn't get, so let's say if Blizzard have a sponsor with Red Bull, you cannot go and get a Monster sponsor if you, the San Francisco Shock, for example. And now this is not unheard of in sports. I mean, there was that big case where the MMA signed a huge deal with Reebok that was very profitable for them, but it locked every single MMA mixed martial arts fighter to use Reebok things. And it was a ridiculous thing. It worked, it went through, and I don't know if it's still going on today, but it was a complete losing situation for the fighters. Now, yeah, I mean, Overwatch League.
Yeah, so, like, just to explain why it's a problem, guys, is basically it comes down to the fact that, like, if you can get your own sponsor, let's say Nike wants to come and sponsor you, but the league tells you, sorry, we're sponsored by Adidas, you're not allowed using Nike. So Adidas doesn't sponsor you. They sponsor the league as a whole, which means that you stand to lose out of money for no fault of your own. You're just the one that happens to get screwed in the deal.
Yeah. So this can be an issue. It can be a big issue. And in Overwatch League, it panned out. I mean, football is a good example where there's a lot of synergy throughout it. I mean, obviously, the Barclays Premier League is not advertising for Nike or anything like that. It's the team will have an Adidas sponsor. A player can have a Nike sponsor. And it's all discussed and worked out behind the scenes. And they make it work somehow. Like, if Pogba is an Adidas player, and sorry to go talk about sports more than I should, but he's an Adidas player. Let's say Man United is a Nike team. If Nike come do a documentary on Man United for that day, Pogba will just sit out of it. That is just the reality. Everybody accepts it. The money is all fine at the end of the day because everybody knows they need to eat. But in the Overwatch League, and like the MMA we mentioned earlier, that was not the case whatsoever because the Overwatch League were allowed to go and get certain sponsors and things, but the teams who had to pay to buy in and really fund this Overwatch League could not because there was always that conflict of interest with Blizzard. So if it wasn't in Blizzard's interest, it just didn't work out. And now let's look at that and compare it to the NBA we mentioned earlier, where the teams and the are basically the owners. The owners of the teams own the NBA, right? That was an example we gave earlier. It's completely different because now essentially the guys you're paying to play for are your bosses instead of you being their boss. They're running a league that should benefit you too. And it comes out no more clearly than in the case that Overwatch League has a revenue sharing system, like all American sports leagues or most American sports leagues. But the way that revenue sharing system works is that it only gets shared amongst everybody after Blizzard takes their cuts to cover all their costs. Now, how does that work in terms of business risk, in terms of who's making the investment, in terms of, like, who's taking the risk here? It's completely the teams with that situation, Prof.
It is completely the teams taking the risk because any sponsor that they bring into the league, that money goes to Blizzard first. So if Blizzard screws them on that deal, sorry, all of your hard work is counting for somebody else rather than counting for you. And you know, you can clearly understand that that is a major issue. Now, the fact that people are still willing to buy in at that point is staggering to me. But that's the circumstances that Blizzard was able to pull off.
And now credit to them and their marketing team for pulling this whole stunt off and carrying on to sell the esports dream. And I think this topic, seeing as how this episode has gone so far, it's quite a difficult topic to talk about because there's so much going into it. So I don't know from Minds and Prof's side if you're doing the best job of it. But I think a very important aspect to talk about here to understand why this is so damn important is that if you think about the conversation about esports, about all the insiders from when the media from the outside starts talking about esports, it's always this case of, this esports, this is a new thing. It's growing. It's going to blow up. It could be so huge. It's going to be like the next sport. But if you look at the actual facts right now, this thing is already huge. And let's look at who it's huge for. It's for the publishers. Valve don't give a fuck if ESL lose money for making every single tournament every year at a loss. Because they know when the TI comes around, they will fund this thing and make $200 million from literally nothing. Just selling hats on the Steam market that they don't even develop themselves, mind you.
If you look at Epic Games, they crowdfunded.
If you look at Epic Games, right? They were... Let's use Overwatch League example first. Overwatch League, everybody calls it a massive failure. Their viewership is dropping. Players are dropping left, right, and center, leaving the game. But the way Blizzard have set up the league, they're always going to make money. They're getting their lion's share of the portion. They're happy. It's profitable for them. It is, quote unquote, huge already for these guys.
I mean, what were the minimum projections? $200 million buy-in? And that's you paying Blizzard for the right to play in their tournament. If their tournament fucks out, you don't get your $20 million back. They keep it.
Exactly. And already, we're seeing big changes in the Overwatch League. Now, Overwatch League is something we've popped on and bagged on for the existence of this podcast, but they've insisted that this league format is the way. It's the way. They've seen the NBA do it, and they're going to do it themselves. But now, there's already rumors of them changing the format of the tournament and stuff, which is not unheard of in esports, mind you. It really isn't. But the precedent that Blizzard have set is a brand new thing. No other tournament organizer before has tried to do what Blizzard has done, where it's a game created solely to be an esport. And getting this level of buy-ins, yes, League of Legends and stuff turned into franchise leagues and stuff later, but it's not the same thing as
Overwatch. It wasn't created like that, yeah.
Right. It was just a game that was made for fun first, and then it blew up, and they're like, okay, we can profit from this. And Overwatch League is not the only one who are making a rigged game in the esports world. Yes, Riot and League of Legends is a far bigger game than Overwatch League, and a bigger game than anything else in the world. But if you hear a lot of the owners speak from the side of Riot Games and Overwatch League, LCS or LEC or the franchise league for League of Legends guys speak. I mean, Rich2K is famous going on record saying that he thinks the League of Legends investment is great for Riot, but for teams, a lot of them, and he thinks the majority of them, are losing money every season. And that cannot be a workable thing, right? Isn't it business relationship supposed to be two ways? It has to be profitable for the client and for the boss?
Well, usually that's how you'd think it would have to run. I mean, some of these organizers seem to have figured out a way to make it not so. But that is, you know, one of those like confusing things that it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like why so many people are getting interested in it. And the problem is that it comes down to the fact that they're being sold a lot of stories by people saying, oh, but, you know, esports is the big thing. So they think that getting involved in any way, shape, or form is great, but it's just not due diligence being done. And unfortunately, like any industry, there are going to be bad actors. And I'm not saying that Riot is a bad actor. They've done a pretty phenomenal job at selling their, selling the ideal behind their company, and selling portions in their league. And they've made their league very, very successful. But, you know, the fact remains at the end of the day that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the big sports, in the NFL, in the Premier League. Those teams own that league. They're the ones that get to choose. It's not some other body that tells them how they have to operate and what league, you know, like what rules they have to play under and what sponsors they're allowed to. They are the ones that get to choose that. So they are incentivized to do a, make a better business of themselves. And you can see Man United was, they weren't the biggest team coming into the 90s. They were certainly an up and coming team in terms of, you know, how to grow themselves. But by the end of the 90s, they were and still are to this day one of the biggest teams in the world because of how effective they had been at marketing their team, at selling sponsorships, and at, I mean, success helped them big time, but you have to give them props that they were still able to do that. Because Liverpool came into the 90s, they were the team of the 80s, they were huge. And where was Liverpool by 2003, 2004? They were nothing in comparison to Man United in terms of just sheer revenues. And that is the real worry that we have here, is that you don't want the Premier League to take 50% of the income and then the teams have to fight for the rest. And the Premier League decides you're only allowed using the sponsor. I don't like you, so I'm kicking you out of the league for some reason that I've just made up, which has happened. Let's not beat around the bush. If Blizzard didn't approve you getting into the Overwatch League, you were not allowed in. If Riot, once you're gone, they make up a ruling and tell you, thanks very much for your money. Thanks very much for getting involved. You have to sell your team. And there's nothing you can do about it. They own everything outside of that.
And I think the big issue also in esports is the conversation about it's blowing up. Yes, okay, it's blowing up. But how do you monetize that? And not to say sports has always been a super profitable thing for everybody involved, or is a super profitable thing for everybody involved now. But there are clear ways to monetize, right? Sports stars at the moment are superstars. They get huge sponsorships and create a huge amount of following and branding for anybody who sponsors them. There's TV rights being sold. Yep. There's games televised all the time. There's already a clear way to monetize in sports for third parties, the teams, right? But in esports, it doesn't exist yet.
I just wanted to bring just to indicate to people like how much a sports star himself can influence things. Cristiano Ronaldo makes more money off of his sponsorships than he does from anything that Juventus can pay him. So yeah. Juventus's fan, or like the Juventus number of official fans, went up by something like 5 million when Cristiano Ronaldo bought them. Now Think about how much additional money that is in terms of contracts you can sign with sponsors, in terms of what players are willing to join you, which again is going to increase sponsors, is going to increase your chances of winning the league, eyes on your product, which means that the whole league can benefit by you doing better.
And the funny thing about what you just mentioned right now, because in H2K's interview with Thorin and Loco Doco, what he said, the only teams that make money are the likes of FaZe Clan, and I can't remember the other one the example he gave, is because that's one of the few teams that have a lifestyle brand outside of the esports. Yep. It's cool to wear FaZe Clan t-shirt. They have these really big streamers that people want to relate to and advertise for them. It's not the esports making them money, but they're the only esports team making money because they brand in life.
They're a brand, not an esports org, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. So I know we're giving examples of players and stuff here from the sports world, but esports players, don't get confused. These guys are also making a killing right now. The esports players and publishers are the only guys making money right now.
Yeah.
But back to my initial point about monetization is that everybody's saying it's going to blow up, but blow up for who? Because like I've mentioned already, for the publishers, it's already an insanely profitable thing. I mean, Valve, as a company, is the most profitable company per employee in the United States. Now, obviously, mm-hmm. that doesn't have to do with the esports side, the Dota and the CSGO. But my point is, these guys have already figured out how to monetize. Last year, Epic decided they were going to host the Fortnite World Cup and put $100 million down to market the game. Because remember, at the end of the day, esports is marketing. Epic Games have this now store that they want to be competing with Steam and such. So this game of theirs, Fortnite, the ultimate marketing tool in the world right now, was last year had $100 million to be put towards their quote-unquote esports. It was a marketing stunt completely, but it worked out quite successfully. They paid out everybody. They committed that $100 million. I'm sure they made more than that coming back in terms of what advertising they got. This year, they decided to do something different. Obviously, they've been doing lots of different forms of advertising and things, but the most apparent one in recent times has been this Travis Scott virtual concert, right? The amount of eyes they had on this was about 30 million in just terms of stream views. In terms of how many people spoke about it on Twitter, articles wrote about it, that is a whole different story. Now, let's think about what they had to do to get this Travis concert to happen. And this is, and it doesn't sound like esports, but hear me out. It's a case of maybe they had to develop, the developers of the game had to go and create this whole scene where they have this massive Travis Scott concert thing going virtually in the game. They had to approach Travis Scott and say, listen, can you do this thing for us in the game on these dates for this time for this amount? And maybe they paid Travis Scott $1 million to do it. Maybe they paid him $5 million to do it. Maybe they paid him $10 million to do it. And that's still a tenth of the price of what they did to do their quote-unquote esports last year. And the marketing is incomparable. I think this Travis Scott concert, virtual concert, so to speak, has been one of the greatest marketing things I've ever seen. How have you ever seen something in the gaming world as spoken about as that prophecy?
I mean, the only thing you could apply it to would be something like the black hole thing that they ran last year on Fortnite, which had like a stupid amount of views.
Exactly. So it was another Fortnite thing that had nothing to do with esports, right? This has nothing to do with esports, but it's so relevant to esports because what is esports at the end of the day? It's marketing. If you Epic Games, they've gone out of their way to say multiple times that they don't want this thing to be a competitive game. They want to keep it fun for the casuals. They're literally going away from esports because their method of monetization is so much easier. You just do pop culture. They've had Marvel tag-alongs in their thing. Every little pop culture thing that's relevant right now, Fortnite is doing it. So that's their way of monetizing. So for Epic Games, esports is not really an existent thing, but they've managed to monetize in the gaming space so damn profitably. Now for the rest of these guys, for Riot, for Valve, it's kind of different because Valve's approach is we don't really care about our esports, right? We just don't give a shit.
CSGO. I mean, like, if you think about the international, I mean, the international is a very good idea, right? So Valve puts on the international. They're the ones that host that event. And from that, they have the Battle Pass, which everybody obviously loves. You know, it's a fantastic idea. But Valve makes, what is it, Camille? I think they make, is it 75% of all of their, the Battle Pass, all of the money spent on the Battle Pass, 75% of it they own, right?
Right. So that 30 million prize pool you see for TI, that's 25% of the money that Valve intakes in that time, yes.
And the guys that run it, as far as I know, officially are the tournament organizer, better known as PGL.
Okay, those guys do get paid out pretty heavily from
Valve. No, sure. But remember, Valve gets, what would be 30 million? That's $90 million from a single tournament. How much does PGL get? As much as they charge Valve.
Yeah.
And that there's no incentive for them to make it bigger. There's no incentive. Like, if their event is better than last year's, it doesn't mean they're making more money. They could 100%. Earn the exact same money, but they'd have to work harder and put on a better show.
Traditionally have a very hands-off approach. Yes, they do the TI for Dota. They don't really do anything for CSGO. They put some money down for the major, or they give the teams or the TOs the license to run the majors. But now, in the Dota scene, it's kind of changed. They're like, okay, this year, we want the structured league format and stuff. They make a whole blog post about it. Not enough details, I think, to run a tournament, but this is exactly how Valve does it. And they have this whole big idea, but the people executing this idea is TOs, the third parties. Mm-hmm. They have to go and now apply, okay, we want to do this thing. This is the amount of prize money we're going to put to, so you guys are going to match that. They run the league. They admin the league. They broadcast the league. They advertise the league. Everything is done by somebody else that's not Valve. So this is free advertising for the Dota 2 game that Valve, okay, it's not completely free. They're putting down 150,000 for each of the leagues in the six regions. But
they also gave you a ridiculous set of like requirements that you had to meet to run your event. So it's like,
exactly.
Oh, you have to have these five languages. All right. So every TO now has to go and find these five specific language casters, and they have to have each of them, which means they have to fly them all through. It's like a ludicrous amount of additional cost for each TO just to run an event sponsored where Valve will give you half of the prize money.
100%. And look at how ridiculous just those set of criteria are, right? So So Valve are going to match you on prize money. $150,000 for this league. You put down, Valve's going to put down that amount. But now the TO are putting on that amount. But now again, look at how much work is there for them. They have to broadcast. They have to get talent. They have to pay talent. They have to admin these leagues. They have to advertise these leagues. So in essence, the time and effort for the broadcaster compared to Valve is at minimum 10 times, 20 times, whatever. It's a very different from what Valve are putting in. And this goes, so again, if this goes bad for Valve, it's only $150,000 commitment for the TO, for the third party who are taking all the risk now and are putting in all the work. It's a huge commitment.
Millions. It'll be millions after a while.
And that is the big issue right now, that esports is already blown up. It's already insanely high money industry. But for who? That's the question, right? It's always for the TO. Sorry, not for the TOs, for the publisher.
For the publishers and the players, because remember, the players, like, at this stage, they don't make enough money where they could be reasonably expected. They're not large enough athletes to reasonably expected to, you know, secure deals and that kind of stuff by themselves.
100%. The players are the other exception to publishers here. Because, like we just said, most teams in the esports sphere lose money, but players still take their $20,000 salaries every month, whether their team are making money or not. And it's not exclusive to esports. I mean, the Detroit Pistons in the NBA, I mean, infamously, they used to be quite a big team in the late 90s and early 2000s. Today, they lose like something like $25 million a year. Or maybe.
I mean, that just basically tells you that you're terrible at your job, because the whole league is one of the best and most profitable leagues in the world. So how the hell are you losing money if you like in a league where you're basically just getting a whole chunk of cash?
And that's not to say that in esports that's not happening, that teams aren't making bad decisions, that they're running completely perfectly, and that the scene is to blame. I mean, there's a lot of incompetence in esports, right? I mean, all those teams signing the Overwatch League contracts, you could say are they just idiotic. Why would they agree to that deal in the first place? So you could look at it from that perspective, like, okay, you guys are adults and you're agreeing to this, so you should take the hit where it exists, because you agreed to it, right?
Yeah.
But
I mean,
the
thing is, if you think about the teams that were involved in the Overwatch League, is some of the biggest teams in the world. Like in esports, you live and breathe by how effective you are at marketing. So the Cloud9s of the world, the G2s of the world, those are absolutely enormous teams that have succeeded on their ability to be fantastic marketing outlets for their various sponsors. So the fact that like those kind of guys are also in the boat where they can't make money should tell you exactly the kind of situation that those orgs are in.
Yeah.
That's just the worrying aspect, is like, if those guys can't make money, then how the hell is anybody making money outside of the TOs and the players? Because the players, remember, the reason why we're saying, like, we're not being mean to the players. It's just the circumstances are they get paid everything at the end of the day. That's it. They get their salary, and if they play well, they might get a bonus as a result of that. But the org alone is the one eating most of those problems when it comes to who's got to pay the bills, where they got to bills are got to come from. So when these devs can basically decide, sorry, we don't like your owner, so we're going to like remove you from the whole league. You're shit out of luck. You can't get any sponsors. That's the only league in town. They run everything. So what do you do at that stage?
100%. And I think maybe a better name way to frame this podcast would have just been esports risk. Who's taking the risk? And that's what actually Matthew Ball has, is his big thing in his article. Because at the moment, it's not a risk by the publisher. The publishers already have successful games going, cough, cough, Blizzard, not really. But they already have these successful games. Whether the esports exist or not is kind of irrelevant to them. It's all the third
parties. They're making money regardless of the esport or not.
100%. So if third parties, the TOs, the teams, etc., are risking it in this esports world, they're putting down their own capital, putting in their own time, and the reward is largely dependent on the publisher itself, because like we said, on a whim, Valve could decide they want to be the host of CSGO now. ESL, Flashpoint, DreamHack, all you fuckers who've been hosting tournaments for the last 20 years, we don't want it anymore. Yep. We're tired of it, and that's just
all your hard work is ours now.
So now you could sit there in your armchair and be like, oh, it's a fucking, look at how dumb all these guys were trying to host a tournament where they don't even own the IP and stuff, like such a bad business decision. But you guys who are listening to the podcast are all esports fans. This is, these companies didn't take this risk. We would not have ESLs to watch. We would not have TIs to watch, because realistically speaking, it couldn't have been a TI if there weren't people hosting tournaments before that. I don't know. That's just conspiracy theory, right?
I mean, esports was never created by the devs.
Right.
Famously, Nintendo tried to kill the esports scene for Super Smash because they didn't like it. They didn't want it. They don't want competition. And that should tell you enough. Like, the devs are profiting, but they were not the ones that originally came up with this.
And till today are not the ones putting up the risk. So on that bombshell prophecy, anything you want to add here at the end of this podcast?
I mean, I just want the teams to be in a situation where they can actually make money. You know, you want the successful teams to be the ones that have done the best job at making it successful and not entirely dependent on keeping a dev who has all the power happy.
Yeah. That is a good sentiment at the end of this. My sentiment at the end of this is that I want people to start thinking about things differently. I think that the traditional sports model, I mean, for all we know, this could be the golden age of esports. We're seeing all these Dota tournaments come out, all these CSGO tournaments coming out. This could be the pinnacle of the sort of sports perspective of esports, right? Because nobody's winning right now except the devs. So something's going to have to change. Something's going to have to give. There has to be new forms of thinking and tournaments going forward. There has to be a more holistic relationship between players and teams as well, because a lot of people before me and Prof have been saying that players have been getting paid way too much. They've been forced, so teams are forced to put their life on the limb if they want to be involved in esports to pay these exorbitant fees. There's a lot that has to change in terms of how esports is run going forward. I think EG as an organization is a good example of that. They used to have players who never wanted to do interviews and stuff before. Now, EG are probably one of the highest content creating team out there. Always on their Twitter, there's something new coming out. Their players are featured in videos with their sponsorship and stuff shown as well. So in this space, they have already shown new ways that they want to go forward to try to be a profitable company. Now, is that going to change the risks of the and relationship between esports tournament organizers and the publishers? I don't think so, but I guess it's a start, right?
It is a start. We just need more of it.
And you know what? We need more of Travis Scott concerts inside of Fortnite. Thank you all for listening. That's the wrap for this Esports Central episode number 84. Check us out on Twitter at KChickDay and at Prophecy Gaming with the CI, not the usual spelling of prophecy. Check out our publication, esportscentral.co.za on the World Wide Web, on Facebook at esportscentralza, and on Twitter at esportscntrl. Thank you all for listening and goodbye.
Cheers.